at Central Time. I'm Rob Parra.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the big test that licenses lawyers. The bar exam has been under criticism after a surprise drop in scores nationwide. We'll find out what's at stake for the profession and the public.
First, even though he's not officially running for president, Governor Scott Walker got some good news today regarding his possible run for the White House. Polls released in early primary states, New Hampshire and South Carolina, show Walker well ahead of his likely opponents. He's currently in Europe on a week-long trade mission. He's going to return to New Hampshire this weekend.
Meanwhile, back at home, two former campaign managers for Walker filed with the FEC today to create a super PAC, which opens the doors for a good deal of fundraising and spending on a potential Walker campaign.
Joining us now to talk more about the latest headlines on Governor Walker is Mordecai Lee. He's a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, a former state legislator. Mordecai, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, let's start with polls in these key primary states. Just how well is Governor Walker doing compared to his announced or unannounced opponents?
Well, he's doing extraordinarily well. We have to remember this is a very crowded field with some declared candidates, some undeclared candidates, but a lot of people who are better known than he is, partly because they're based in Washington, like, let's say, U.S. senators. The fact that he's broken out of the pack so quickly and so early and so discernibly is, I think, good news for him with an asterisk. You know, when professors talk, there's always an on the one hand and on the other hand. And on the other hand, it's that if we think about the Republican nomination race 4 years ago, there seemed to be a kind of a candidate du jour in the sense of sometimes Newt Gingrich was ahead and then he faded and then Michelle Bauman was ahead and then she faded. In other words, the question is Governor Walker merely the flavor of the month, or is this really a kind of a permanent wave of popularity? I guess it's probably towards the latter, but American voters insist on being unpredictable.
Especially in primaries.
I'm not sure either of us should make any predictions.
Well, pollsters will say, hey, this is a snapshot in time. So looking at this particular time, why do you think Governor Walker is having a good showing in key early primary states?
Well, you know, he's an excellent politician. He's very sure-footed. He's very disciplined. And I think, besides the fact that he hasn't made any gaffes, is the fact that he appeals to several of the silos within the Republican Party. You know, when you think about it, there's a kind of a Chamber of Commerce, Country Club Republican Party. There's the Tea Party, which is ideological and conservative. And then there are the religious right, who are ideological but more on values, on culture, rather than on economics. He's succeeded in building a reputation where he's not only acceptable to those three silos, but he's popular with those three silos. That's an unusual accomplishment in the Republican Party, where it's a kind of you stick to your silo and you have trouble breaking out of it. So that might be one of the reasons for his success so far.
Another factor that you wonder if people consider is a pragmatic issue. Can we get the candidate who most reflects our views, whichever group we're talking about, and has a shot of winning in the general election? Do you think Republican primary voters are weighing that, and do you think Governor Walker comes up well when they do that?
You know, even though Governor Romney was eventually the nominee from 4 years ago, and one would say that based on the way you described it, that he came across as more electable than some of the names we've mentioned so far. But I'm really skeptical that primary voters or caucus attenders care as much about electability as they care about agreement on substance. In other words, they don't vote for a moderate because the moderate is more likely to become president. They sort of vote their heart. And that's why when we talk about primaries and caucuses, we tend to say that on the Republican side, the caucus goers and primary voters are more to the right of the party itself. And we say the same thing about the Democratic Party, that the primary voters are to the left of the mainstream of the party. So I'm not sure that's the factor. After all, you could make the counter-argument that he might not be as electable as, I don't know, let's say Jeb Bush or some of the U.S. senators because he doesn't have experience in foreign policy. And right now, foreign policy tends to be a very important topic.
Talking to Mordecai Lee about Governor Walker, a lot of headlines, a lot of news about him on the primary trail, though he's not officially a candidate yet. Well, let's tackle that point. Hillary Clinton is in the race on the Democratic side. We've had a few Republicans announce. What kind of strategy factors, tactical factors, are going into the when to announce decision for Governor Walker?
I think that's a great question, Rob, because he's everything except a declared candidate. He's traveling to the primary states. He's giving speeches. He's creating a political infrastructure. The public rationale that he's offered is that he wants to wait until the budget clears the legislature. He signs it with his line item vetoes, and then he's sort of done for the summer. I tend to think that that might be the public rationale. That might not be the political reason. There's a political reason for not declaring or not even having an exploratory committee, and that's the legal status is different. So right now, he can be supported by the what's called the 527 or by this new super PAC that just began today. And he doesn't have to disclose his donors. There's no limitation on donations as there would be if he had an exploratory committee or if he had a if he was a declared candidate. So I think he's trying to maximize the situation of being able to raise money without disclosure and without the routine limits that there are for presidential campaigns. And so the longer he can do it, in a sense, the better off he is.
You mentioned that super PAC. It's called Unintimidated. That's new. Now, what can that do that 527 couldn't do previously?
Right. A super PAC is theoretically an independent entity that can explicitly support a candidate. And if we look at what happened 4 years ago with Romney's super PAC, it can trash the opponents without necessarily dirtying the fingers of the candidate himself or herself. But I think there's something else going on here. If we think about all the litigation about John Doe 2, and I don't want to imply anybody's guilty of anything in John Doe 2, but the legal principle that's being fought is the issue of coordination. That's a really important legal issue. And up to now, super PACs could exist only if they explicitly did not coordinate with the candidate. If the opponents of John Doe 2 succeed in getting to the U.S. Supreme Court with their argument that the coordination clause across the board is unconstitutional, then a super PAC can even more explicitly coordinate with a candidate. So I think there are a couple different things going on here, but this certainly is part of the choreography, or maybe you'd call it the political striptease of becoming a candidate, and that's having a super PAC that's backing you up vigorously.
Now, some news closer to home, also in the poll field, the Marquette Law School survey out with some new numbers today, including a 41% approval rating here in Wisconsin for the governor. That's the lowest in the 3 years that they've been doing this poll. What do you make of those numbers?
Well, I think it's a combination of anticlimactic phase of being reelected. After all, he won reelection in a really tough fight, although he ended up winning by a very comfortable margin. And then, in a sense, maybe there's a kind of a sag in his political standing. But I think it's more the fact that he's been running for president. He's been out of the state a lot. He's been traveling a lot. And he really doesn't seem to be vigorously fighting for his budget. Those kinds of factors, for example, as he's been traveling, he's been talking much more about controversial social issues that he never talked about in Wisconsin. For example, he volunteers his position on funding Planned Parenthood. He volunteers his position on abortion. I think the fact that he's so overtly talking about social issues means that he's sort of reminding some Wisconsin voters where he stood on the issues that he never wanted to talk about when he was a candidate for reelection. So it's probably a combination of things, but I have to tell you, Rob, that I'm really taken aback by the news that's coming out of Joint Finance. It's almost like a disregard for the positions he's recommending. When you compare how Joint Finance reacted to his proposals 4 years ago and 2 years ago, now it's almost like they're viewing him as a governor of a different party who they don't have to listen to. It's almost like his views and recommendations aren't carrying as much weight. And I think this is significant, and the 41% that you mentioned, Rob, in the poll maybe is an indirect confirmation of that sort of fingertip feel that politicians have about other politicians.
Now, the governor doesn't have to face an election here in Wisconsin anytime soon. Do the things we just talked about, that approval rating, the TIF, the differences with his own party over the budget, does any of that matter out on the primary campaign trail?
You know, it probably doesn't, in the sense of if he runs and wins, of course, it wouldn't have mattered. If he runs and loses and he comes back to being governor of Wisconsin, he'd have plenty of time to build back up to popularity if he wanted to. But, you know, it's also possible that if he doesn't win, that he might want to leave the governorship. And I'm not at all saying that's what I'm recommending or that I think is going to happen. But it might be that after running for president and the vigor of it and the sag in his popularity in Wisconsin, he might feel, again, I want to be careful with comparisons, but you remember how Sarah Palin decided that she just sort of after the excitement of being on a presidential ticket, she wasn't interested in going back to being governor, without in any way suggesting that Scott Walker is like Sarah Palin. That might be a kind of a political phenomenon in a reaction to the intensity of running on for a national office.
A lot to happen between now and then. Mordecai, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, longtime political observer, former state legislator. He joined us to talk about the latest news on Governor Walker and his likely presidential campaign.
First, for most lawyers around the country, the bar exam is a major stepping stone or hurdle. It's needed to practice law almost anywhere in the country. Wisconsin is a partial exception.
The exam has gotten some criticism in the past from people in and outside the legal profession that flared up after the release of a set of test scores last year where the percentage who passed that exam dropped significantly from previous years.
That's led some law professors and deans to say there was something wrong with the test and that it might be time to rethink the bar exam's role in licensing lawyers.
Erica Moser joins us now in the studio. She's president of the National Conference of Bar Examiners based here in Madison. Erica, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, before we get to the particulars here, briefly, what is the purpose of the bar exam, big picture?
Big picture is attempting to establish whether an applicant has entry-level knowledge and skill to become a practitioner. In other words, it's an entry-level examination, not a predictive examination for how somebody's going to function in practice over a career.
Now, as I mentioned, almost everyone around the country wants to practice law. As I understand it, has to take the bar exam. Wisconsin is partially an exception. Can you explain how it works here in our state?
Wisconsin is unique in the United States in that it offers something called the diploma privilege, whereby students who qualify graduating from one of Wisconsin's two law schools, Marquette and Wisconsin, are able to be admitted without taking a bar examination. When I began in bar admissions, there were four other jurisdictions that also had the diploma privilege, all of which eliminated it. So we are unique. Of course, Wisconsin does administer a bar exam for those who come from out of state, that is, people who graduate from other law schools.
So if I graduate from somewhere in Illinois, want to practice law here in Wisconsin, then I would have to take the bar exam.
Absolutely.
So from the perspective of the public, what's at stake here for people when it comes to the quality of a lawyering we can get in this certification process?
Well, the only reason to have a bar exam, and frankly the only reason to accredit law schools as the American Bar Association does, is consumer protection. And for those who assume that every law school is of equal quality, I can assure them that's not true, even accredited schools. And every graduate of every law school is not emerging from an institution of equal quality or capable of entering the profession. And just as we license doctors with examinations and real estate brokers and truck drivers, it's entirely appropriate, in my view, to have a common examination that everyone takes that levels the levels of playing field for against law schools and against graduates from law schools.
So a slow-burning controversy in a way, a big drop in test scores seen in ones administered last year. The scores came out in the fall, and the drop led some people in law schools, some deans and some professors, to say there was something wrong with that particular test that made this happen. It wasn't the students, it was the test. Was there? How do you try to figure that out?
Well, we try to figure it out by taking a look at how we score the test, including something called equating the test, which is to set the test that we gave last July on the same scale that we administer for any other of these multiple choice tests that we give. They're given twice a year. I can tell you that because the drop was not as dramatic as you may visualize. It sounds more dramatic when you say it than it really was, but to the extent that we we're concerned ourselves. Obviously, we're interested in doing things right at the National Conference of Bar Examiners. We revisited the equating of the examination, the scoring, multiple times, both internally and externally, and are more than satisfied that the test results are correct. The curious thing in your question to me is that when the test is a messenger, the message is that something was amiss with the cohort that sat for that exam last summer. And the answer is not to eliminate the test. It's to take a look at who's going to law school and how they're being educated.
Talking to Erica Moser, president of the National Conference of Bar Examiners, about the bar exam required to practice law in much of the country, required for people coming to Wisconsin from the outside to practice law here. Well, let's get into that last point you mentioned, Erica. And this was controversial, again, amongst law schools, law professors, because you're saying, in effect, the test dropped because you're sending less qualified students, I think, to take the test in the first place.
Well, I think it's a broader picture than that, and there are more variables than that. And I think one of the unfortunate things about the rhetoric surrounding this issue is that people are trying to paint it in primary colors, and it's far more nuanced than that. But just to attach some meaning to what's going on, the law school enrollments have been in a free fall. Law school applications have been in a free fall. But what we're seeing are two things that I think are important to realize. One is that while applications are down, enrollment is not down as far as applications. So students who ordinarily would not have been accepted to law school are now being accepted. If there's anyone out there who's interested in attending law school, it is truly a buyer's market right now. The other factor that is inescapable is that if law schools become less selective, they really do have an obligation, in my view, to make up whatever educational deficit exists by the students toward the bottom of the class that they admit. And as we look at the numbers, just to give you a picture, in 2010, 52,000 or more students entered the first-year class. This last fall in 2014, the number was not quite 39,000. That's a huge drop. And at the same time, law school enrollments have not dropped enough. So what we're seeing in the literature, which is actually developing to a much greater extent, is that it's curiously and sadly, students who are at the top of the LSAT, the law school admission test scores, seem to be staying away from law school in greater percentages than students who are at the weaker end of the spectrum, that is the ones who have the worst scores. Now, an LSAT score isn't the be-all and end-all, but it is a critical indicator.
So is this reflecting maybe a market where the lawyer jobs aren't out there like they used to be, where that person who scored really high in the LSAT might be successful, says, you know what, I have better options elsewhere?
I think that it's commonly known, and the deans certainly know this, that employment in the legal education, in the legal market, has been drastically down. It seems to be beginning to come back, and so there, in all this gloom, there is some cause for optimism. However, I've heard predictions that next fall's entering class may only be about 35,000. And if those predictions are true, we haven't seen the bottom yet.
Are we in a situation of peak law school in a way? We have too many institutions with too many openings, more than are needed, and that's why they're accepting more students who may not be ready to pass the bar when they graduate?
Well, if you realize that legal education is largely funded by student loans, that's the fuel that drives, that pays the faculty, and faculty salaries are a huge piece of this, you have to have a certain number of students to keep the doors open. And it's understandably tempting to balance that budget by bringing in students you might not have admitted 5 years ago.
So bringing it back to the bar exam, does the bar exam change over the years? Does it need to change to keep up with the times in any way?
It should, and it does. Anyone familiar with the bar exam knows that that we've added a skills test to the bar exam over the past 15 years, that we adjust content. There are changes that are constantly being made that are actually public. Part of the difficulty I've encountered is that applicants understand what's going on, bar applicants, but this has really finally hit the deans where they live, because they're driven to a large extent by the ratings in the U.S. News and World Report. And finally, the deans are paying attention. And I think they're facing enormous economic and educational challenges, and it's a very tough time to be a dean.
Are you worried that other states would start omitting the bar exam, going to that graduation diploma privilege you mentioned?
No, I'm fearless. They should do what fits their needs for their own consumers the best. Where jurisdictions have investigated the diploma privilege, even recently, such as Iowa, it's been rejected. So I don't see it to sweep the nation.
Erica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Erica Moser, president of the National Conference of Bar Examiners, based here in Madison.
Well, love it or hate it, work is one of those things in life that most of us have to do. But not all jobs are created equal when it comes to work satisfaction, pay, and career prospects. In a rapidly changing economy, sometimes we need a little help figuring out which ones are on the way up and which jobs are spiraling downward.
With that in mind, the website CareerCast.com is out with their 2015 Best and Worst Jobs Report. Contains some good news for those of you who know your way around a math problem. Bad news if journalism and broadcasting are more your thing.
Joining us now with a look at the best and worst jobs for 2015. Is Tony Lee, a publisher of CareerCast.com. Tony, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about what makes a good job good and a bad job not so great.
Sure. Well, we look at a wide range of criteria. Some of the obvious things, like, you know, what are you earning today versus what your earning potential is in the future? You know, what's the employment and unemployment rate now versus job growth projections, you know, moving forward? And then we look at things that are, you know, a little more micro, I guess you could say, things like the level of stress in the job. You know, are you in the public eye? Do you have constant deadlines? Are you being asked to do more with less? Are there actual physical demands of the job? And at the worst possible stage, is your life in danger in that job or the lives of others that you work with? So there's a wide range of criteria that we look at.
And before we dig into some of the particular jobs, Tony, I imagine there are people who hate the best jobs and people who love the worst jobs on the list. What kind of feedback do you get from people who see these lists and say, hey, no, that doesn't match my experience?
Yeah, I mean, we hear from people every year who say, you know, I can't believe you've rated my job as one of the worst. I love my job. You know, lumberjacks, firefighters, people who get into the job because of the adrenaline and the things that they do, they don't care that it's, you know, possible you're going to get hurt or your pay's not very good. And the same on the flip side. You know, there are people in some of our best jobs who say, you know, well, I got a terrible boss, so my job's not so good. There's always particular issues with any job. What we do is try and come up with criteria that allows folks to look and say, yeah, this is generally some of the reasons why this job is great and the reasons why this job wouldn't be so great.
Well, we're going to zero in on the top of the list. The number one job is actuary, and this is part of a group of jobs that seem to have quite a bit to do with math. Let's look at the top. What makes actuary and some of those other top jobs good?
Well, in terms of any job that's related to a STEM career, so science, technology, engineering, math, you probably all heard this, you know, for a couple of years now. If you've got those skills, then there are opportunities for you in the job market for a long time. And the reason is there's just shortages. There aren't enough people who have those skills who are applying them in these types of careers. So whether it's an actuary, which is someone who, you know, figures out, you know, the life expectancy of things, they work for insurance companies, they work for construction companies, lots of different types of companies. There's a large number of folks who are hitting their retirement age and not enough new folks coming into the field from below. So what that does is it pushes up salaries, it creates a better working environment because companies will try and make the job easier to attract people, and it just makes it for an overall higher-rated job.
So if somebody wanted to tap into these potential jobs, obviously math skills would be at the top of their list. Is that enough, though? What else do they need to make sure they're getting the better jobs in these higher-ranking categories?
Well, you know, many of these jobs do require an advanced degree, you know, at least a college degree in the field. So you can't just say, you know, hey, I'm a janitor, I think I want to be an actuary tomorrow. You know, there is some education that's required. But once you have skills, you know, where we get a lot of very positive feedback is from teachers, you know, middle school, high school teachers who are saying, you know, my students may be good at puzzle solving, may be good at equations, but don't really know how to apply this in a career. This is great information because we can talk practically about here are jobs that you might be a good fit at. You know, when you take these things that you like and that you're good at and then start thinking about jobs for them, here you go. Here's a list of long-term careers that could be very profitable for you.
As you said, actuaries is number one. Can you first of all remind us what exactly an actuary is, and then tell us what other STEM jobs are in that top 10?
Yeah, it's so funny because every time we talk about the actuary job, the first thing people ask is, so what's an actuary? What is it? What does an actuary do? So actuaries are typically people who will work with statistics to figure out the life expectancy of people, of bridges, of buildings, you know, lots of different things like that. There's a very large society of actuaries that have, you know, tens of thousands of members, so it's a fairly populated career, but you have to be very good at numbers.
And some of the other ones in the top 10 of these math ones, before we set the numbers aside for a minute.
Sure. Mathematician, statistician, data scientist, which is a new one this year, that's up at the top. And then we have some other that are more kind of, you know, math, but healthcare related. Audiologist is second, biomedical engineer is fifth, and then your typical dental hygienist actually makes the top 10 list as well.
So looking a little beyond the top 10, but still toward the top of the list, if science, tech, engineering, math, they just aren't your thing, what are some other good options for people?
Yeah, so if there are jobs that don't require an advanced degree that where you're still in healthcare, like medical records technician, physical therapist, there are other jobs where you can do very well. I mean, the jobs that show up, you know, surprisingly high on the list without a college degree would be hairstylist, fitness instructor, jeweler. You know, so there are some jobs that rate well in terms of good opportunity, very low stress, yet you don't have to have an advanced degree.
Well, let's go to the other end of the list now. The worst jobs, and one at the bottom, and this has been there before, I think, newspaper reporter. Why is this consistently low and now the worst this year?
Yeah, so it has fallen to the bottom for a number of reasons. You know, it's one of the very few jobs where there's actually negative hiring growth anticipated for the next 8 years, meaning there are going to be fewer people in this job every year over the next 8 years. At the same time, the salary is expected to fall. But at the same, you know, concurrently, you're required to do much more in the job. So before, a newspaper reporter might, you know, go out and write two articles a day for the paper. Well, now they have to not only write the articles, they have to also write it for the website. They also have to have social media and tweet. They have to have a Facebook page that they're updating. They have to take video and go to meetings and be prepared to take video and upload it. So while it was, you know, a 24/7 job before, it's even more so now with many more responsibilities. And the irony is that the number of people who want this job is actually rising. So you've got new college graduates who are willing to become newspaper reporters for minimum wage or even as unpaid interns just to get the experience, which pushes out people who with experience. So it's a tough profession to be in right now.
So that's specifically newspaper reporter. Are the prospects better for other kinds of journalists?
Yeah, and we actually say in here that there are journalists who have transferred their skills out of the newspaper world into, you know, social media purely, into public relations, into corporate communications. So you can take those same skills and apply them to different careers. It's just working specifically for a newspaper that makes it to the bottom of the list.
Now, getting outside of journalism at the low end of the list, you mentioned earlier some jobs that, you know, involve some elements of danger, a firefighter, lumberjack. What are some of the other jobs like that at the lower end of the list?
Yeah, enlisted soldier in the military is near the bottom. Photojournalist, even though it's journalist, you're out on the front lines. You're covering the fire. You're covering the battle. So you're taking the same risks as everyone else. A corrections officer, which seems, you know, fairly obvious. And then actually taxi drivers on the list. It's the number one profession in the country where you're most likely to be a victim of crime. So that ends up there as well.
And enlisted military personnel is also down there on the bottom end of the list.
Yeah, and it's funny. What's changed for soldiers is that, you know, not only is the job inherently dangerous, but the career prospects aren't as good as they used to be. You know, it used to be that you could say, I want to be a career, you know, military person, and with the drawdowns and other changes, you may not even be allowed to re-enlist. So, you know, the career prospects aren't as good as they used to be either.
But people might argue back, A, this might be a calling, a desire to serve the country, or maybe an experience that will help them in later job opportunities outside of the military.
Yeah, no question. Again, you know, with a lot of these jobs, the people who are dedicated to doing them really don't care that it doesn't necessarily pay well or that there's a lot of danger involved. You know, they're motivated by other things. And so if that's you, if you're motivated by running into a burning building and saving people because that's, you know, where your mind is, then it doesn't matter that it's the dangerous job to you.
Now, this is a list of 200 jobs, and one of the things you watch for is motion. What's moving up quickly? What's moving down? What have you got your eye on for next time around?
Yeah, so every year we add new jobs and remove jobs that aren't as populated, meaning fewer people are in that job, and we add jobs where there are many more people coming in. So I mentioned data scientist, for example, is a brand new job this year. There are now enough people in that job for it to emerge. We added other jobs like sustainability manager, which came in well, not in the top 10, but high. Social media manager was another one that emerged for the first time this year. So, you know, we're always watching. Biomedical engineer came in the first time last year. So we're always watching for new jobs that are kind of emerging and adding them to our list.
Tony, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
That was Tony Lee, publisher of Comcast.com, with a look at the best and worst jobs for 2015.
Now we want to hear about your best or worst job of all time. What made your awesome job great? What made your worst job miserable? If you heard something on that CareerCast study in the top or bottom, were you in one of those jobs? Do you agree with where it rated? If you could start your career all over again, is there another line of work you'd want to pursue? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. We just heard from Tony Lee of the website CareerCast about the best and worst jobs of 2015. And now I want to hear from you. What was your best job ever, your worst job ever? If you had a great job, what was awesome about it? Or what made your worst job miserable? Was it your career prospects? Was it how much you made? Were you actually in danger on your job? Something our guest says makes for a job that comes out more toward the bottom of the list. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And I'm curious, and I bet the answer to this varies from person to person. What makes a job satisfying, a good job for you? Is it the tasks, a sense of providing service, a sense of control over the workplace, the money? What makes a good job good? What makes a bad job bad in your mind, in your experience? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts, your stories on the Central Time Facebook page. And in this study we just heard, I'd love to hear from actuaries out there. It's supposedly the best job out there. What do you think? And worst jobs are some dangerous things. A lumberjack, firefighter.
Enlisted military personnel.
Right, which I could see some people loving, really finding a calling on, as we just heard. Let's hear your story now. 800-642-1234 is the number.
And we go now to Kennedy joining us in Madison. Kennedy, hi.
Hi, yes. I thought it was funny your comment about actuaries being the number one job and not a lot of people knowing about them. I actually, when I met my fiance, he's an actuary, and the way I kind of have been describing it to people is they are kind of a weatherman for the financial district, and so it definitely is a good job, and he loves it, and so if anyone's interested in math, definitely go into it.
So he's got that aptitude of math that we were talking about.
He does. Yes.
All right.
Not so much my strength, but he definitely loves it.
Does he does love it. He finds job satisfaction in doing this actuarial work.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, and I know now I have a lot of friends who are actuaries as well through him, and they all seem to really enjoy it as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kennedy, for sharing that, getting us started. Now, how about you? Best, worst job experiences at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Sue in La Crosse now. Sue, hi there.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's your story, Sue?
As those of us who are resident caregivers, it would be a tough job that is great for the most part, you know, with the appreciation and the family members' appreciation and everything, and just seeing you enhance lives. But it's a very tough job because it's very high stress, maybe for the most part low pay unless you are in a county facility or something like that. But anyway, it's, you know, no college involved, just the training you get as a CNA and along the way.
And Sue, I understand, I've known people who've done jobs like this. It sounds like it can be emotionally draining and physically challenging. Am I right about that?
Exactly. You know, sometimes we're in a facility that is assisted living, which ends up being quite a bit like working in a nursing home because the people, the folks, stay there. You don't just, like, shove them out the door when they get more needy with cares, you know. It's a tough job.
Sue, thank you so much for sharing your story. How about you? We're asking about your best job ever, your worst job ever, and what made it so. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Thanks to Sue for the call. And on we go to Elizabeth in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Well, my worst job was probably working in a perfume factory when we were in college. A bunch of college kids worked there. We came out just smelling of perfume every single day, short breaks, the same tedious type of job every day, and it really made us college kids want to return back to college. It was a great motivator.
Well, I have no idea how you make perfume. Were you part of the, I don't know, assembly line or the people
assembly
who package the perfume?
Yeah, assembly line, putting on caps all day long, you know, labels, and it wasn't automated as much back then. So it was pretty boring, but I went on to become a teacher, and I'm happy with that job.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing that story, working in a perfume factory back when she was a teenager. Elizabeth, thanks for that.
We'll go now to Peter in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi there.
What job do you want to tell us about?
Well, I was I'm listening to the radio, and I found it interesting that firefighter and lumberjack are so low on the list. I myself am a sort of a land manager, and I do a lot of restoration work with prairie and forest, and it's kind of a combination of lumberjack / wildland fire and prescribed fire.
Yeah.
And I would just say that I love my job and the improvement that I get to see in the land and the people I get to work with and work for, the conservationists in that community. There's no better thing for me, that's for sure.
And Peter, do you get to work in some cases on the same plot of land over a period of years?
I do.
So you get to see a change over time.
Yes, it's very encouraging. We lots of times you'll go through the seasons and you get to see the different prairie plants that are coming up, and you really get to day by day and also year by year, you get to see the value of the land and how what your work has done to improve it.
Fantastic, Peter. Thanks for that. So, yeah, you get to see the product of your work in the long haul. You wonder, am I changing anything? There it is. Thanks for that, Peter.
And we'll go next to Patty in Ripon. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
Hello? What is your vote for best or worst job?
I was a combat medic in the Army for 6 years, and I thought it was the best decision I ever made. It really set me up for a long-term career, and I got to take a year off of nursing school, and I really, really enjoyed doing it.
It sounds like a job that would be high stress. It sounds like you found it meaningful, though.
Oh, I definitely did. It just kind of defines who I am now, even years after being out of the military, and it really set me up experience-wise to know and have that background in my job and my resume. And I think that people find the military intimidating or not for them, but I was out of shape and young and female, and I was not your idea of a typical American soldier, and I still found a lot of passion and love in that career.
If you don't mind my asking, what are you doing now?
I'm a nurse.
You're a nurse, so you followed that career right along. Well, Patty, thank you so much for calling and sharing that.
We are taking your calls for best and worst jobs ever. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When I think combat medic or paramedic or nurse, emergency room, I have immense respect for people who do that. And I think I would be terrible at it. I don't think I could handle that kind of work. I'll say if you are ever in one of those positions, you don't want to see me being in that line of work. We've got Richard on the line now in Ettrick. Richard, hi.
Yeah, how you doing? I completed 34 years in the military.
Wow.
In 2011. I just want to say that was the best career move I ever made. Great people to work with, get to see lots of different places in the world. Some bad places along the way, but I guess that's part of the risk, but the adventure was great. And now I'm in my second career as a farmer, so it's just been great.
That's quite a change, though, career military to farmer. How has that transition been for you, Richard?
Been real good. I like being outdoors and raise the beef cattle and hay, and it's been a real easy transition out there. My wife loves it. It's nice to spend more time with the family now. So.
I bet. Richard, thank you so much, and thanks to all of you for sharing your comments, your stories, and remember, you can keep telling us about your best and worst jobs ever and what made them the best and worst jobs ever. Just head over to the Central Time Facebook page, share your story there, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.